that, I'm going to tell you the time I thought you were the coolest.
We can certainly try to keep him going, to keep him alive. But his quality of life is poor at this point. Your father's dying.
I'm done. You're not there 24/7?
No, you are.
I have to do this?
Yes.
No.
Oh, what possessed you to do this? He's not feeling well, that's all.
Oh, he's a hearty guy. He'll be better soon. You know what? I'll make him some soup. Mung bean soup.
You know, I'm still on the fence about this, Kenny.
Shut up, Dad.
Hello and welcome to the Matt's Movie Reviews podcast. I'm your host, Matthew Pekovich, and this is episode number 189. Out now on Amazon Prime and due for release on March 15 on iTunes is Nothing to Do, an incredibly touching comedic drama that tells the story of a 50-year-old man who takes care of his father after he's placed in hospice care. A powerful film that I admittedly watched through tears of joy and sadness. Nothing to Do is a must-watch for everyone listening out there. And joining me today to talk about Nothing to Do is the film's writer and director, Mike Kravinsky. Mike, I thank you very much for joining me today on the podcast.
Oh, thank you, Matt. It's really great to be on your show.
So look, this is an incredibly touching movie, and I've read that it was actually based on your own experiences with your own father. When you're thinking of movies, stories, your next project, was this experience that you had with your own dad something that came to mind straight away, or was it quite a bit of a process to think about those final moments with your father and putting that together to make a screenplay?
Well, it's interesting you bring that up. I had done a previous film, and we had gotten distribution, and so I could sort of forget about that one while somebody else took care of it, and I was moving on to try to write a new film, and I went through, I don't know, a few months, 2-3 months of all these false starts of story ideas, and it was getting a little frustrating, and I wasn't sure what direction to go, and all of a sudden my wife, Lisa, who is also the composer for Nothing to Do, sorry, that's my dog.
That's okay.
she just suggested, why don't you do a story about your father and your experiences caring for him? And all of a sudden, it was like a light switched on. I was able to knock out the first draft probably in a month at 110 pages. And probably a year and 24 drafts later, I had the full screenplay. And the reason that it was just such a quick writing, the writing went so quickly was because the experience with my dad was such an emotional time for me. It was just, people say, what was it like? And I say, it was stressful and profound.
Yep.
'Cause I was the guy. You know, my brother was here, but at the time he had a full-time job and he couldn't really, spend the time with him that I was able to. And so I was the guy. And, I saw him from the moment he came into our house to the moment he passed, I was there. And, it's something that we all are going to go through or have been through. And, the people who've seen the film say, you got it right. This is exactly what I went through.
Was it a case, Mike, that this was a film that you necessarily didn't want to make, but that you needed to make? It was some sort of a therapeutic kind of cathartic thing for you?
No, not necessarily. Although I will say that seeing some of the moments on the film and writing about some of the moments, brought back some, not just sad moments, which is, of course, you're watching the end of your mother or your father. I can see where, it obviously is bringing on, a lot of tragic memories. But at the same time, there was a lot of really touching moments and funny moments in caring for my dad. And, you know, so I don't know if it was something I had to write, you know, just to kind of get it off my chest. But the one thing I do know is that the people that we have shown the film to in public spaces and festivals and private, you know, in screenings where, you know, we've had some local screenings here in the Washington, D.C. area. Everybody is, you know, the only word I could use is that people are touched by it because they you know, it's something that they understand and it's a life experience that they can really relate to.
One scene that kind of, to me, brought the whole movie together, it was touching, it was sad, it was just funny, is the scene where Kenny, who's the main character in the movie, and his dad, Irv, they confess to one another, these kind of silly confessions that become more and more profound as they go along. Was that something that actually happened with you and your own father?
Well, I will tell you that, yes, there were you know, things that we talked about, you know, that we both experienced, him as my dad and me as his son, and things that I might have done that, you know, he wouldn't have approved of when I was younger. But that's what that whole period of time was like. You know, there was just a lot of just these conversations that you wouldn't have had if your parents were in good health. And it's not so much as a confession as, you know, everybody's letting their guard down.
Yeah.
And everybody's, you know, talking about things that they normally wouldn't have talked about, you know, because it's like none of it matters anymore. And, you know, it's just, you know, it's just you and your parent, you know, your mother or your father, and you're just sitting there and you're just like, oh, remember this? Well, you know, it's because of that, you know, and then, you know, your parents will tell you something about your childhood that you never knew, that they didn't feel that they should ever tell you, but now they do.
When it comes to casting the character of Kenny, who's, I saw one way he was described was aimless. He was an aimless 50-year-old. He's a radio DJ. When it comes to casting, did you know exactly what you were looking for in regards to image, in regards to, I mean, because essentially he is an extension of yourself. Am I correct in assuming that?
He is, but he's an extreme extension of myself. Kenny, although me personally, I didn't feel as if I was an aimless person. I spent almost 30 years working for ABC News in Washington and as an editor and technical director. I was a relatively responsible person in my life, but caring for my dad at that moment, I just, you know, there were just moments of feeling just so overwhelmed by the responsibility that had been thrust on me that, you know, I felt that when I cast the character of Kenny, he needed to be somebody who was played by Paul Farrenkopf, who did an amazing job, by the way. It needed to be somebody who had never accomplished much in his life, and this was his big moment to be truly responsible and to be, you know, to be the guy that helps his father through this moment. And his whole life is nothing but, you know, basically at 50 years old, there's nothing but, you know, parties. And, you know, I made him a DJ because I don't know if you know about I don't know what it's like in Australia, but I know the life of a, you know, a DJ, here in the States, it can be kind of a, you know, kind of a nomadic life.
Oh yeah,
you
know, same, I mean, here as well.
You work in all these different stations, and you know, some program director doesn't like you. Well, you're looking for a new job, and you know, I mean, so I wanted him to have a job that, you know, it didn't seem like it was a career, as opposed to a bunch of, you know, moments, you know, a bunch of different jobs in his life that he stuck with, and again, you know, something without a lot of responsibility. And that's why I made him a DJ. But, you know, in the foundation of all of that is someone who is basically challenged to do something he's never experienced before and tries to do it as best he can.
Paul Farrenkopf, who you mentioned before, he does play the part of Kenny. He is indeed amazing in the film. The one thing that really struck me, though, when I saw him on screen is his voice. He's got this rich kind of timbre voice, which I think is really suited to the fact that he is playing a profession where, like, his voice is his main kind of, you know, his main tool, his main weapon. When you first meet Paul and you hear that voice, did you know straight away this has to be the guy to play this role? Because above all the other things that he is, which is a great director, that voice itself is such a commanding instrument.
I agree. And you know, it's funny, we go to screenings and people always ask, you know, when Paul is there, people always ask, he says, are you really a DJ? Because he has that voice. But no, he's a local actor, you know, here in the area. And, you know, he's just somebody who is really talented and really chill. You know, that's another thing that I wanted, just somebody who's like, you know, sort of took life as it came and, you know, didn't seem to be shattered, you know, didn't seem to be rattled by anything. You know, it's like, oh, I lost my job. Okay, I'll go get another job.
Yeah.
You know, and that is, you know, what I wanted the character of Kenny to be. And Paul, he's like, you know, as I say, he's an amazing actor, but he's also very chill, you know, and that's just who he is. And, you know, so when we talked, you know, when we were doing the casting and we talked, I was like, you know, this guy, he's like perfect. He's just like, you know, I mean, not just as an actor, but just in who he is as a person.
When it comes to the role of Rachel, she is the sister of Kenny. So she's more like kind of like the responsible one, I guess, of the two siblings. When it comes to creating that character, she's not based on anyone in your life. Like, Phil and Irv, of course, are based on kind of like a relationship between you and your father. You brought in a fictional construct in between in this dynamic. Why did you feel it necessary to bring a character like Rachel into it? And what was the process like in getting Connie Bowman to play that role?
Well, you know, I had worked with Connie before, and so I knew her style of acting. And she played the, you know, she plays the tightly wound person really well. But the reason that I made Rachel, played by Connie, who she was, is I wanted her to be the exact opposite of Kenny. You know, Kenny is like, you know, whatever, you know, and Rachel's like, you know, is like, no, we need to have a plan and we need to do it this way. And you're going to do it this way because, you know, Kenny, you haven't thought this through,
yep.
You know? And so, you know, actually the first time you meet Rachel, I really wanted the audience to not like her. And you know, because all of a sudden, you know, there's this like Kenny and he's kind of chill. And then like all of a sudden here comes this tightly wound person. And the first word she says in the screenplay, in the film is no, you know, and I really wanted that to be the start of our introduction, to Rachel. And, you know, and then as the film goes on, you start understanding why she is the way she is, you know, she's having her own issues. And so there's a lot more empathy for her. But in the beginning, I wanted her to be the exact opposite of Kenny.
It also comes down to that when it comes to issues like hospice care or treating someone when it comes to the end of the life, it could be such a stressful experience as well. I've seen firsthand how experiences like that can really split a family into two based on where they're coming from, ethical decisions, etc. And I think you really touched on that quite well. Is that something that a lot of people brought up to you as well when it came to festival screenings and such?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, that's really common, you know, everywhere. You know, like, the way I describe it is everybody wants to do what's right, but what's right isn't always the same thing.
Yep.
And, you know, in the case of Nothing to Do, Kenny's like, you know, Dad, whatever you want, I'm here for you. I'm going to help you. And Rachel's like, no, we're going to send him back to the hospital to get better, which is really an impossibility at this point.
Yeah.
And that is a really common, you know, moment with families that my brother-in-law, who is a geriatric physician in Atlanta, he tells me all the time. He says, you know, when a parent is getting close, there's always arguments in the families, you know, and they've got to work it out on their own. And I actually, we have a scene in a funeral home, and I was talking to the funeral director, and he said basically the same thing. He says, you know, I'll be sitting in there in the office, and we'll be filling out forms for caskets or urns or something for a family member before they pass. And they are just, the families, you know, just are arguing about, you know, everything. Because, you know, again, you know, it's just such a stressful and emotional time for everybody. And he says that what he does a lot of times when this happens, you know, family members start arguing in front of him, you know, in his office. He says he just closes his order book and he just quietly walks out of the room. And when, you know, the yelling stops, he comes back in.
Hmm.
And he finishes the order because it's a personal thing. And, you know, you don't want a third party there to watch what's happening. And, you know, and families have to work it out for themselves.
It's very true. And usually, eventually, they do come to some sort of agreement.
I agree. Yeah. It
really interesting to me is that this, of course, is an independent production. With an independent productions come restrictions, especially when it comes to scheduling. You have a limited amount of time to shoot your scenes, get things done. You, for this movie, made sure that you implemented a rehearsal period beforehand. I think I read 3 weeks of rehearsal for the cast and stuff to get things done. How important to you was it to get that rehearsal process in so when it came to filming, you guys could just move from one scene to the next and get things rolling?
Right. Well, actually, it wasn't 3 weeks. It was 3 months.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. But that being said, is that all of the actors and crew and stuff, I mean, they all had full-time jobs. This is an ultra-low-budget film, and, you know, it's the only way that we could operate is to rehearse everything on the weekends because everybody had full-time jobs. And that's, I suppose, if you broke it down, you know, to the actual number of days, it would probably be about 3 weeks. But then, you know, that's the downside is that you were sort of having to work within everybody's schedule because, you know, it's a low budget film, but at the same time, we would rehearse on say a Sunday or a Saturday, and then we would have a whole week for everybody to kind of think about what they did. And then they would come back and they'd be even better than like, say, if we were rehearsing every day.
Hmm.
Because they had time to think about what they were doing, and they would, you know, the actors were great. They were, you know, if you give them, you know, the story plot or these lines and stuff like that, they would come back the next week and go, what if he said this instead? And I'm like, that sounds great. You know, like my feeling was with Nothing to Do that I was open to all suggestions from the actors, from the crew, from everybody. And you know, if it made sense and it didn't change the story, you know, generally speaking, I accepted the changes, mainly because everybody, particularly in the cast, everybody had experienced what I had experienced with my dad. And so they brought some real, you know, emotion to what they were doing based on their own experience.
Your foray into filmmaking is such an interesting story. You mentioned before you had a career at ABC News as an editor and a technical director. You essentially made the switch to filmmaking, I think, in 2010. How old? You have been around 55 years old around that time?
Exactly. Well, like 56, I think. Basically, you know, the news business, you know, because of all of the new outlets, you know, online and you know, smaller, you know, like BuzzFeed or, you know, Vox or something like that. You know, basically, you know, the larger news organizations are having to accommodate and having to downsize, you know, based on this new medium that's coming in. And so, you know, I accepted a buyout from ABC News after 29 years. I was like, well, I was still pretty young, and I was, you know, it's like, okay, what do I do now? And I, you know, when I was when I was in my 20s and first starting out, I thought to myself, you know, I think I'd like to do, I got hired by ABC, and I thought, I'll do a year here, and then I'm going to move out to Los Angeles and get into the film community out there. But ABC turned out to be such a great place to work. I mean, terrific people, amazing experiences, you know, just a really excellent career. I stayed. And so now that I was gone, you know, I took the buyout, and I was sort of untethered at this point. You know, I just figured, okay, let's revisit this whole filmmaking thing. And so I'm in effect, you know, it started at 56, 55, 56. I started basically over from scratch. You know, yes, I had a lot of technical experience, but the difference between doing news or doing documentaries versus doing, you know, fictional narrative stuff really is day and night. You know, I mean, how you deal with the crews, how you deal with the actors, you know, how to get the best performances. This is all different than news. You know, news is very immediate, and you know, there's no real acting in it, you know, I mean, per se. I mean, you know, maybe somebody you're interviewing might be trying to, you know, create some emotion or something like that. But generally speaking, you know, that's not the goal. The goal is to get the story out. With narrative filmmaking, you know, you want to get the most powerful performance. You want to get people to push themselves emotionally to get something so you can, you know, really tell a story, a powerful story.
One thing I read is that you wished you had done a few short films before you jumped into feature-length filmmaking. Why do you think doing a few shorts would have benefited you as a filmmaker before doing your first feature?
Because I knew nothing. I didn't know anything about filmmaking, and it just would have been a better learning curve. And that's what I recommend to people now, you know, that are starting out, is that, you know, just do a few shorts. They, you know, get your friends, you know, write a story, you know, shoot it the best you can. Don't worry about, you know, getting rights to stuff. I mean, just go out there and get the experience. And that's what I should have done. You know, because a great story that I tell about being a filmmaker was the very first scene in the very first film I ever did. I didn't really know as much as I thought I knew. I thought I knew a lot, but I didn't know much of anything about narrative filmmaking. And I remember the first scene was I was standing behind the cameraman, the director of photography, and the actor that I wanted was supposed to walk across a parking lot, and he was on, like, I don't know, 50 feet away, and so I yell out, "Okay, go," and nothing happened. And the director of photography turns to me and quietly goes, "Say action." and so all of a sudden I yelled action, and he started walking. And I was like, okay, see, this is stuff that I needed to learn. So I tell people now, I mean, even to this day, it's still, and will continue to be a learning experience for me. I learned something new about the process, about acting, about the technical side. I just, every film I do, I look at every film I've made and I say, oh, I should have done this, or I should have done that, you know, oh, this would have been better if I had taken this and turned this this way, but these are all things that, you know, it takes you know, decades to learn. But, you know, I have the time, so I'll keep learning.
One thing that always comes up when I speak to independent filmmakers in regards to a learning curve is the process of getting your film distributed. It's one thing to make your film. It's another thing to get that film in front of the people for them to watch it. You were speaking before about the changes in the news industry. There's been many changes in the film industry as well. Now you can watch a film. It's a much more intimate, kind of compact experience. You can watch it on your phone and your iPad, in a bathroom, wherever. So as an independent filmmaker, having these kind of streaming platforms, online platforms, do you view this as very much a benefit on your part as to make sure that your films can get out there to be seen by as many eyeballs as they can?
Right. Actually, you know, the same technology that caused ABC News to offer me a buyout, you know, back in 2010, is also the technology that permitted me to make films. Mm. You know, everything has gotten smaller. Everything has gotten less expensive. And you know, in my feeling, it is that it really democratized the process. And as time has gone on between 2010 and now, you know, somebody like me who does these, you know, small ultra low budget films, there is this whole structure of organizations that like help you get distributed, that help you, you know, for color grading, for the sound design, there's all these groups now that help the small filmmaker, and particularly with getting distributed. You know, as I had mentioned, my previous film, Geographically Desirable, got a distribution deal from a company, when I look back on it, and I have since, you know, the deal has lapsed and I never re-upped on it. So I got the film back and I realized, you know, I put it on Amazon Prime and Amazon, you know, Amazon pay-per-view, and, you know, and all of a sudden people started watching it. And it occurred to me that, you know, for somebody like me, I don't need a third party to distribute the film. I can distribute it myself. I mean, I can, you know, put it on all these different platforms. You know, there's a PR firm. There are PR firms. Like, I'm personally working with a company called October Coast in Los Angeles and in Melbourne.
Yep.
And they, you know, and they work with small filmmakers like me in getting the word out. They're fabulous. And that's what my feeling about, like, for small filmmakers, you can get your film out and it looks exactly the same as, say, I don't know, Green Book or Black Klansman or anything like that on Amazon. The only difference is that they're like really big films and you're really small ones. But, you know, if you look at the page on Amazon, they look exactly the same. And you know, so for somebody who's like interested in, you know, doing a film and feeling like you're going to be like, you know, out in left field, you know, when it comes to distribution, you're not. You know, you have all these options of getting the word out. And also distributing your film on platforms, just like, you know, large budget, you know, big name films. And so for me and for all filmmakers, I think it's a really great experience, a really democratizing experience.
Well, as someone who has seen Green Book and Black Klansman and now your film as well, Nothing to Do, I can definitely say that this film holds up against those kind of like big kind of studio films as well. This was such a rewarding watch for me and for everyone out there listening right now on Amazon Prime, March 15 on iTunes, Nothing to Do. I can really recommend this movie. This is a movie that make you laugh, make you cry. I've actually put it in my list of manly movies that make me cry. It's up there with Field of Dreams and Rocky and such and that kind of thing. I do have a list of that, by the way. I should make write it up and put it on my website.
Mike,
thank you very much for your time today. Congratulations with the movie. This is a really touching film, and I think Like myself, I don't have experience in regards to first-hand experience in hospice care. I know some people who have. I have had family members pass away over the last year. And I think these themes are universal. So I think a lot of people are going to really look at this film and really embrace it like I have. So congratulations to you, Mike, with the film. And hopefully we can talk again in the future in regards to any more films that you make in the future.
That would be great. And thank you thank you again, Matt, for the interview.
Okay, for everyone out there, March 15, iTunes, Amazon Prime right now, nothing to do. Mike Rubinsky, I thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome.